Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about what's happening in the world today. We talk about where we think the world is going, and we talk about the future. And we take a pretty unusual view of those matters, to wit, we believe that there's a pretty good case to be made that the world might just be getting better all the time. We believe that if you're not excited about the future, maybe you're not paying attention. We believe that something is going to happen, something wonderful. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Happy holidays to you, Phil.
Well, a Merry Christmas to you. How's it going? You all set for the big Gordon family celebration?
Actually, we already had part of the Gordon family celebration today. Got together with my folks, and you know, the kids all got to open a a single present, and and there was additional presents that came from uncles and aunts and stuff like that for them and stuff. It was fun, and so that was, that's round one of the Gordon family Christmas, and I guess we can say it was a success. So everybody's
outstanding.
Happy. Yeah.
Glad to hear that. Whenever I stick somebody's name on it like that, I always think about that movie Christmas Vacation. Right?
The Griswold family vacation.
Yeah, I dedicate this tree to the Griswold family Christmas, right? I dedicate these lights to the Griswold family, right? It's always that.
You know, I just love those shows. You know, I think there's a little Griswold in all of us, you know. You know, the guy that never says die, no matter how bad it gets, you know.
Yeah, well, you get me messing with, like, lights and things like that, and it turns into a scene from that movie pretty fast, I have to say. It can get ugly. We've also got our chat host, Michael Darling, on the line. Michael, how are you?
I am on top of the world.
Wonderful. Glad to hear it. You all set for Christmas?
It's like 3 weeks away, right? I got plenty of time. I'm
good. Yeah, got loads of time. Don't even sweat it, man. Yeah.
Yeah, go back to bed. It's gonna be okay.
Sometime later this week or next week, you can start your shopping. You know, nothing to worry about there.
I concluded over the weekend that skipping Christmas just because we were too disorganized to remember it was this week would be unacceptable.
Yeah, well, I think the boys would remember even if you and you and your wife forgot. That's the problem.
Oddly, it seems to be true.
Yeah, they're getting cues elsewhere. You know, besides from the instruction they're getting from their parents on that one, I think they're gonna know what's up. So, well, hope you guys have a great Christmas. And I'm now going to introduce our very special guest this evening. We're really pleased to welcome back to Fast Forward Radio, Brian Wong. Brian is the director of research for the Lifeboat Foundation. He's a longtime futurist, and he's been involved with Nanotechnology Association since 1994. He's a member of the Center for Responsible Nanotechnology Task Force, and he moderates the Technology Subtask Force there. He's also on the Nanoethics Group Advisory Board, and of course, famous to readers of The Speculist, where we're always linking to him because he's the mastermind behind The Next Big Future, one of our all-time favorite blogs. Brian, welcome back to Fast Forward Radio.
Glad to be here.
Well, we're really, really pleased to have you here. And Stephen, give us a little history on how Brian came to be on the program this evening. I think this is kind of fun.
History as in like 30 minutes ago. I just saw Brian on Google chat, and I just paged him, and he happened to be free to come on the show tonight. So our show plan went from winging it to getting to interview Brian once again about all the various things he's been blogging about at his blog, and so we're excited.
Well, we're really pleased. You know, we were excited to have the chance maybe to wing it, but we can always try that some other week. And of course, we've talked about doing just a total stream of consciousness show of one of us. But I think a stream of consciousness show for just two of us would probably be marginally more entertaining than that. I want to say something about our program. I have been, you know, I was on this. I had mentioned I was on this exercise kick where I was doing this weightlifting stuff, and about 2 weeks ago, I decided I would add running to this. There's this track at the gym, and I thought, well, I'm just going to start running 2 miles a day, you know, get some cardio going, in addition to the strength training. And so when I run, and I'm working on my time now. And I've been Twittering about this, how my time's getting better. And in fact, the first few days, it was like this, you know, hockey stick curve of improvement in time. And I was saying, you know, at the rate I'm improving right now, I will be like a world class runner. You know, I'm going to be Usain Bolt here in like 6 months or something like that. Of course, unfortunately,
I have a prediction that you're going to you'll reach a plateau before then, Phil. But I mean,
yeah,
that's just a pessimist of me.
Sadly, already occurred, and the gains are coming much more slowly now. But what I was going to say was, as I'm running, I get out the iPod and I listen to reruns of Fast Forward Radio. I subscribe on iTunes to the program, and I've been listening to our show. And you know what? Just got to put modesty aside here for a moment. I think we do have a pretty entertaining program, I have to say. I mean,
we try, don't we?
It's not just a matter of enjoying listening to the sound of my own voice, which I am big on that. I do like hearing myself talk, but we get into some pretty fun stuff, and some of those shows we've done have been a lot of fun, and a big part of that has been that we've been able to line up really interesting, fun guests, people who have fascinating things to tell us. And Brian, you're in the elite group now. I think this is what your am I thinking correctly? Fourth appearance on Fast Forward Radio, is that right?
Yeah, I think that's right, including the unconference talk there.
That totally counts. So yeah, I mean, at this rate, again, counting you know the increase, you know the growth curves here. At this rate, you're going to pass PJ Manny here in a few weeks, and then you're
going to
be.
when you talk about the multiple appearances on a show, I think of that Saturday Night Live thing where they had Tom Hanks talking about being one of the five timers on the Saturday Night.
Absolutely, yeah,
that's right. You'll be a five timer here next time.
Yeah.
So.
That's right.
That's a great bit. Steve Martin was there, right? And they're doing that secret handshake. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You're great.
We got to come up with a secret handshake fast.
Yeah, but yeah, you're just one away from the big five. So we'll have to have some kind of celebration and recognition of Brian's fifth appearance coming up very soon. I'm sure it won't be long at all. So, so you guys got into some topics as you were chatting, Stephen. Why don't you get us rolling on what you and Brian were talking about?
If it's okay, Brian, I would like to start with your last topic first, because it really, it's about a subject that our guest from last week has conceived of. Jay Storshall, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, Phil, since he was on the show just last week. Is that correct?
Sounds right to me.
Okay, good. He's the guy who, of course, conceived of utility fog, and we just gave that far too short a shrift last week. But he's come up with another idea, and Brian, if you could kind of lead us into it, I sure would appreciate it.
Yeah, so his new idea is to use nanotechnology, and not even like didn't sound like it would take full nanofactory scale nanotechnology to achieve, is to use a lot of little small balloons, about a millimeter to centimeter in size, that have a very thin shell of diamond, about a nanometer thick, and it have a mirror in the middle of it, and so if you switch the side, it'll be a few nanometers thick for the whole thing. And so you'd make them so that they would float up at 20 miles in the atmosphere, And if you cover the globe with them, take about 10 million tons of material, and basically you could control the light going through them. You put a little electronics in it, GPS, receiver, so they could turn themselves, and basically be kind of like the little micro mirror TVs that you have where you're controlling the mirrors to deflect and stuff. And you can control sunlight all over the Earth, and you can also, you know, focus it down and have concentrated solar panels to collect the power. And basically you'd be pretty close to, in my opinion, getting to using that to become a Kardashev type 1 civilization. Basically you're using all the solar power that hits a planet.
Okay, and what you would do with these tiny mirrors that are floating, like, did you say about 20 miles up? Is that
20 miles up? 20 miles up.
Okay. If your concern was that it was getting too hot, you could you could reflect light out.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose if it's getting too cold, you could it could be like you could just turn them around the other direction, and they'd be like mirror shades, letting light in, but then reflecting it back down to the Earth. I guess you could do that too. Huh?
That's right.
And if you wanted to be neutral, you just turn these little mirrors sideways and let the light just come through, like as if the mirrors weren't there at all.
That's right. So James Torrance Hall points out that they control about a kilowatt per, I think, square meter of light, which is how much is hitting up in the top atmosphere there.
Mm-hmm.
And the CO2 that we're concerned about for global warming is basically about one watt per square meter. So this kilowatt basically would overwhelm that effect by about 1,000 times.
Okay. And
wow, this is so cool. I have to give a little background on when we had Josh Hall on last week. When he and I met up at the UN conference, he was actually doing this talk on his weather machine. And I said, hey, you've got to come be on our podcast. We'd love to talk to you about this. And we got so interested in artificial intelligence and then finally utility fog, we never got around to talking about this. So, Brian, I'm really glad you came on tonight so we got to hear about this.
No problem.
This is great. Although we've cut into one of his topics next time he's on, but we'll be familiar with the idea. So that's
right.
So that's good. Now, for these balloons to be deployed, am I understanding that you need nanotechnology of the sort, the molecularly precise manufacturing techniques that we talk about in order to deploy this kind of thing? Is this as far down the path as utility fog, or is it somewhere before that?
I think it would be before utility fog. The main part of it that you want the nanotechnology for is mainly for the low-cost manufacturing. Because you're making 10 million tons of and each one is, of 10 million tons of fairly, very light material, right? So these balloons, right? So you could, I think, with the kind of nanotechnology we have now, like a carbon vapor deposition of a thin layer of diamond, you could make something that you could then, convert into this balloon. The problem is just that it would be so expensive to make each one. I think you probably could have a research project of, just ballparking, say 10 million or maybe at most $100 million, you can make some balloons. The problem would be that they'd be too expensive for you to deploy. You only get a few up and you wouldn't be able to do anything with it. So you have to be able to get the cost down. If you get them down to, say, $10 a kilogram, then your 10 million tons would cost $100 billion. So that's relatively affordable, considering how much we're spending on bailouts and stuff. $100 billion, you can control the weather. The other aspect of it, and Josh points it out and I point out, is that obviously if you can control the light and control the weather, that's insanely powerful. But that's, to me, just something that falls out of the fact that if you're Kardashev level one and control several thousand times, 2,000, 5,000 times 10,000 times more power than our civilization does now, then by definition you become very powerful.
It seems like if you could, it could be deployed as a weapon. You know, a civilization that controlled that could, for example, you know, have make it very hot in one section of the globe, turn a country you didn't like into a desert if you wanted to.
That's right.
Yeah.
Or, you know, crank it up even more and cook the people or whatever. Yeah, very nasty things.
Yeah.
And it'd be tough to defend against. One other aspect of it was that he had a version 2 of this, which was that's a little bit more difficult, which was to add an aerogel inside, aerogel being this very light gaseous solid, you know, kind of like gas-like transparent solid, and a switchable antenna unit with cross links, and basically you can tune the absorber and the emission of radiation, and basically with that control the frequency, direction, and phase of the light that goes through. So basically you can have this layer where you can basically programmably control and tune the light that you have coming onto the planet.
The first version of this would float because it's hydrogen, correct? These are hydrogen balloons.
Yeah, you have to fill it. I just fill it with some kind of like gas, hydrogen, to float it up there. Or if it was tough enough, I'm not sure if you would evacuate or something like that to make it again. Probably you'd fill it with hydrogen. Probably the easiest way.
Okay, and they'd be. I assume they'd be solar powered. What little power they'd need, would you get it from the sun?
Yeah. I would think that if you're controlling the light and stuff, that whatever power you need for electronics, you could use solar power to power it.
And then later generations, it sounds like, did I understand you to say that those would just be the little vacuum balloons, right? If you've got nanotechnology, you can just have balloons that have nothing inside them, and of course they'd be able to go as high as you need them, taking a little air for ballast.
The issue with that, I think, would be just to have it so they didn't collapse. If you made them up at the level that you wanted to, then you can maybe get it to kind of balance out. So if you made them up high, if you made them down, you know, down the ground and had them float up, then you'd have the problem of would the structure collapse on itself. But if you made it up top at the low pressure level, then we wouldn't have that issue. Just make it, you know, where it would kind of float at that height, you know, at the 20 mile level.
Very cool. Well, this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking with futurist Brian Wong about various topics related to the future. And if you're interested in joining our discussion, we have a live chat going on if you're listening live, or you can leave comments at our blog at speculist.com. So what's interesting here is it sounds like Josh came up with this idea related specifically to weather control, which is a very ambitious thing to do anyway. But there's what I understand you to be saying is that there's another application for this, which is the generation, the production of energy. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, so that you can use it to guide, divert however much solar power you want and concentrate it up onto massive fields of solar power that you'd be solar panel collectors, whatever you'd be producing with the slightly more advanced nanotechnology that you'd have. But you could concentrate up, you know, like 1,000, 10,000 times whatever your the temperature limit of the material that you're using to collect it with. And then you could, cover that 1% of 1% of the area to collect all solar power that you want. Be nearly as much as the solar power hitting the Earth, but you wouldn't want to take it all because you still want sunlight going to other places and doing some other stuff with the biosphere. But you could basically use it as a way to more easily collect up the solar power.
It's very cool. But here's my initial thought about this is I can sort of see why you'd like a whole bunch of little balloons for controlling the weather. For collecting power, couldn't it just be one big one? Why would you? Is there an advantage to having a bunch of little ones for
No, you're right. You could for the you could do it for big ones too, probably. It just happened to be that since judging the calculations on it, that it was easier for me to figure out how to scale it to say, okay, here's how much material you need for the whole planet and that kind of thing. Larger ones could also work as well. One advantage to Josh's kind of a smaller unit is, you know, that you can have within the small sphere the means to that second generation one to control the phase and do various other tricks with it. But if you're just looking as cheap as possible, you'd create a larger structure. Like, actually, there is a company right now called the Cool Earth that is using 6-foot mylar balloons to concentrate solar power onto a solar cell. So you can definitely use a larger balloon to collect all your power.
And their obviously their reason for doing this is for energy collection, not for any kind of they're not in the early stages of weather control, right?
No, they're not. No, they're just looking to make solar power collection as cheap as possible.
You know, that's interesting. I heard someone had an idea recently, and I guess I'll have to pull the story and post it in the show notes. You know, some guy wanting to basically just take dust and use cannons and blast it into the stratosphere and see if that could affect bring down temperatures. You know, I guess if you did enough of it, perhaps for short periods of time, and I guess this particulate would slowly filter back down to the Earth, I suppose. But you know, it's sort of a low tech version of what Josh is talking about, I guess.
Yeah, there's several lower tech and cheap ways to counteract any global warming. Either creating some kind of artificial volcano or throwing up little bits of like dirt particles, whatever like that, choosing the right ones that counteract the effect. And there's some that are very reversible, where and you can do it localized, where where you're changing the weather over a smaller area, you see, okay, did that work? And then you've done the work, and you say it settles out, and you don't have to worry about it being something that, you know, oh, it doesn't do what we want, and now we're screwed even more. It's, yeah.
I've even heard there's another one using earth-moving equipment to put soil on top of the ice caps. You talk about a major earth-moving.
Wow.
You know, I would suspect that would be not cost-effective. Can you imagine the amount of diesel they'd have to burn to darken the ice caps?
Right, but luckily all those diesel fumes would probably be darkening the ice caps as you go, so there might be
maybe so.
Might be an added benefit there. It's interesting, though, to think about the world that Josh envisions there. I mean, the end game of weather control, we were talking before the show started about these big snowstorms that have been showing up lately. I mean, there was this nasty ice storm on the East Coast a couple of weeks ago, and that's not freak weather by any stretch of the imagination. That's going to happen every now and then, but it was bad. I mean, you know, people were without power for some of them as of last week. They still didn't have their power on. And you think about this kind of technology, this cloud sitting up there of these little balloons. Okay, so the front's moving in. It's like, well, we need the moisture. We certainly don't want to not have the moisture, but maybe we'll tweak the air temperature just enough so it comes down in the form of rain. And then you go, well, but long term, if we always do that every time it's going to snow, the world's going to get too warm, and we're gonna actually impact the climate by never letting it snow. So it's like, we'll let the rain fall, and then we're gonna really drop the temperature down. So we'll have we'll have everything we just had. We'll have the cold temperatures and we'll have the precipitation. We just won't have them at the same time, and then the you know, all the infrastructure doesn't get frozen, and you don't have this big this big mess with schools closing and power lines going down and all that kind of thing. So I can imagine doing something like that. But we were talking about they had these unusual two freak storms in Houston.
Vegas.
Where else did we say? Las Vegas.
Oh, yeah.
Vancouver, yeah. Seattle, right? Places that don't normally get much snow. Suddenly they're getting a lot of snow. So would you use technology to prevent snow from happening ever in those places? And if so, I guess, I mean, the world would be kind of a less interesting place to some extent, would it not?
Yeah, I think you have to, you know, achieving total control might not be the best choice, but you want to have a certain level of control just to prevent the catastrophe scenarios that people talk about, or where not even just for civilization changing it and causing global warming and that leading to bad result, but even if natural processes, solar activity, increase in the sun, et cetera, like that, that it, you know, if natural, unnatural, we end up dying, that's just not a good thing. So we just want to have the thermostat, keep it in the range we like, and then, you know, if it goes to above 80 or 85, whatever, just bring it back down.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I guess, come to think of it, my concerns about climate are a little misplaced because essentially climate is now pretty much in our hands at that point, right? If you can keep the planet at the temperature, you know, within some range that you want it to be, that is the climate, right? I mean, it's right. Not going to be a strictly natural process anymore. Well, it's a fascinating idea.
Phil, you used the word endgame relating to this idea of Josh's. It seemed like last week, if we had a theme last week from him, it was that all this stuff is closer than anybody realizes. So, you know, I don't know how far away the end game will be.
Well, here it is, Brian. We've got you on the line. So when do we have these things, do you think?
It's definitely looking very achievable, I think, within 20, you know, definitely within 30 years, and could be even earlier than that. There's interesting capabilities being developed with DNA nanotechnology. Eric Drexler at his new blog, Metamodern, pointed out a two-page plan by George Church, George Church is a leader in DNA synthesis and synthetic biology. And George was indicating that DNA synthesis and nanotechnology could get to very low cost manufacturing of like only a few dollars per kilogram, which is about a billion times cheaper than current production. And he described a few ways that could happen. Definitely he's an expert in that field. And if you could get to a billion times cheaper DNA nanotechnology, that gives you a lot of capabilities because there's other research where DNA can be used for electronics. IBM's been using DNA to place carbon nanotube grids. There's already been work where DNA can assemble and glue a 3D structure of a million 15-nanometer gold particles. They're making all kind of synthetic DNA, kind of extending the chemistry toolbox beyond what's the natural, quote-unquote natural DNA. So it's to be able to already have this level of DNA nanotechnology capability and bring the cost down a billion times would be huge.
A billion times.
Yeah, a billion times.
That's
right.
Quite an improvement.
Yeah.
Yeah. How many orders of magnitude is that?
That's 9 orders of magnitude.
Yeah, 9.
And so he said the two things are engineering or of more efficient nucleotide synthesis. So he's working with Philip Morrell on optimizing metabolic pathways to synthesis the 4, what he calls DNTPs, and I haven't looked that up, DNTPs in vivo. I think nucleotide, whatever things, TPs, and DNA secretion. Natural process on bacteria can be enhanced to prevent potentially toxic levels of DNA in vivo. So he says those are the key things that
that he think the work on that would enable that. And he also had a bit more in his two-page outline of a plan to achieve that. And you know, he didn't put a, I don't think he put any time on it, but the stuff is racing ahead pretty fast. And the plan is actually a year old already. It's over a year old. He put it together in April 2007.
Oh, so this is this is work that's ongoing. He may have achieved some additional parts of that since writing the paper. Is that possible?
That is possible because he's involved all over with all kind of companies in making DNA synthesis. You know, every company that's you know like oh we're gonna make $5,000 method to sequence the whole genome or $1,000 or $100. It seems George Church is on the board of practically all those companies.
Cool stuff. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking with Brian Wong about weather control balloons and DNA synthesis, and we're going to get into DNA engineering here as we move on into the second half of the program. So this is what's interesting about this these list of topics as I saw these, because when we think about a much more efficient nucleotide synthesis, when we talk about all this work with DNA as DNA, you start to think about, well, there's all kinds of health benefits, there's all kinds of medical benefits. And that's great, but you know what we're seeing on top of this is DNA electronics, DNA being placed, used to place. You were talking about these carbon nanotube grids. When we start talking about DNA being used to do those kinds of things, we have you know Christine Peterson and some folks from Foresight Nanotech on the program a while back, and we were we've talked about the roadmap and we've gotten into you know, some pretty specific definitions around what all this means. But we just come back to this idea of, well, what are we talking about when we talk about molecular manufacturing or you know, nanotechnology? We're talking about atomically precise systems. We're talking about manufacturing down to the molecular level of precision. And I guess my question is, if you use IBM uses DNA to place carbon nanotube grids, I mean, aren't we there, right? Isn't that the molecularly precise manufacturing that we've been looking for, or how close does it get us to that? It seems to me it's a huge step in that direction.
Yeah, it's a pretty huge step in that direction. The single wall carbon nanotubes, I think, are still still over a nanometer. In just over a nanometer in thickness. But I think for the molecular precise DNA nanotechnology, it's more controlling each of the chemical reactions that you want. And DNA, the carbon nanotubes are molecules, big honking molecules, because if you have a really long one, you know, like one that's microns or more in size, you're talking about millions of carbon atoms. So they're really large molecules. So, and when you're placing them, you're not really, even though you're controlling it to nanometer precision or something like that, it's still not, you're avoiding the reactions. You've already made it, and you're avoiding chemical reactions. And so you're getting this very tight construction precision, but it's not, you're not controlling each of the chemical reactions that you want to have happen in that area. So the full Drexlerian vision goes beyond this. Although being able to do what we're talking about, especially if you do it really cheaply and affordably and do it, you know, for dollars or pennies on the kilogram or ton, something like that, that would still be huge. You can do, you know, the stuff that we're talking about with Josh's thing and being able to, you know, make yourself into a civilization 1,000 times, 1,000,000 times more powerful, but you can go even further by controlling all of the chemical reactions.
Yeah, I guess that comes back to the whole wet versus dried nanotech and the when you start using DNA to do some of these things, it's a very clever application of biotechnology, but you're still not all the way to the actual, I guess, machinery. I mean, you are in the sense that that machinery is a pre-existing element. It's a pre-existing entity that we're taking advantage of, but we're not building the machines ourselves yet.
Right. I think it just as a matter of how many, you know, if you only have one really good trick in your toolbox, you know, that's good. You can push it pretty far. But if you have more of this molecular control, then you have a bigger toolbox and do more stuff with it. You know, we can, you know, even with what we've had, you know, we make 2.5 billion tons of cement every year and a billion tons of steel. So we do a lot with, you know, even the crude stuff we have now. But if you can go even further with scaling up and just, you know, making more ways to get to getting things cheap and precise and controlled and programmable, then you can do even more. Because the thing would be that if you're placing using DNA to place the common nanotube, you don't have much programmatic control. So if you want to get all the way to this programmable matter, then you need to control the reaction. They can do more in terms of other ways to exponentially scale it up and keep costs down and do all kinds of other tricks. So having, you know, just like the difference between, I guess, a computer that's programming and doing calculations versus maybe an abacus. You know, you can do calculations with it. With the abacus, it's physical and you're doing stuff, but then with the computer, you can do more and faster and scale up more.
Yeah, or maybe it's let me try an analogy. Maybe what we're doing now with DNA electronics or, you know, placing nanotube grids with DNA is like some kind of early Fortran programming. And what we really want is to be able to, you know, develop full-blown web apps, right? I mean, that's kind of the difference in scale and scope between what we're talking about doing. So, because to an extent, I mean, it's not completely inaccurate to say that something like electronics that are laid out that are synthesized using DNA. To a certain extent, that is programmable matter, right? I mean, we're kind of in the early machine language days of it, but it actually is that.
Yeah, the thing is, and there's ways that you can extend the chemistry of the DNA nanotechnology and get to where you want to go, which is kind of, you know, it's not the technological determinism. Basically, you still have to work at it. You have to find a way to push it beyond where you want to achieve. But it's it does seem like, if you're looking at a way through the technology dominoes kind of things, you know, that is still a pathway to achieve the ultimate capabilities that we want.
Right, right. Although I think ultimately as you said, we're going to want some tools besides DNA. We're going to want to achieve that level of control using some different approaches, and we want to have different machines down there working. But I guess all this organic stuff has always been kind of the proof of concept for nanotechnology anyway. So it only makes sense that some of these early real true signs of progress towards what we're hoping to see eventually happen would come from that realm.
Yeah, because it just one, it turned out the DNA was so much easier to work with, and being able to, you know, apply it to cells and do other things, just it's been a very rich area.
So what is the DNA electronics all about? What kind of electronic components are they actually able to produce using DNA?
I think they've used synthetic biology to create all kinds of different electronic components. They haven't done it on any kind of large scale, as far as I know, but definitely they, you know, you can transmit current down DNA, and then you can shape it to the structure that you want so that it becomes the different electronic components. So I think it's pretty complete in terms of you know, antenna transmission, the various other things, circuits for computing and stuff. I think they've pretty much done at least one off on a fairly complete set. It's just a matter of they haven't been able to, you know, integrate them all into, you know.
Is a huge part of it. Reading from your blog, Brian, it says potentially DNA could address or recognize features as small as 2 nanometers. Cutting edge chips today have features that average 45 nanometers. So,
right.
You know, a huge jump.
Right. I think there's a lot of different things competing down to the 10 nanometer feature size, and then there's various things that they think could work down lower, and beginning down to 2 nanometers with the route, you know, definitely would be something that should be interesting, and just a matter of whether they can make that competitive cost wise and you know, like I say, scale it up.
Okay.
Ultimately, you look for this this picture of, and I don't know how realistic this is, but vats of electronic components growing, right? I mean, in place of manufacturing electronics, and that's probably not entirely appropriate because not everything that goes into electronic equipment that we might purchase would be produced by DNA. But the components themselves, I mean, once you're producing them this way, it seems that the cost of producing them is reduced to a very small amount, and the ability to produce them becomes this, you know, vast geometric thing, not unlike growing algae in vats or something like that. Is that a reasonable picture, or am I engaging in fantasy here?
Well, I think if they can scale it up so that it's 3D and scale that level, then that could be something that's pretty competitive. My doubt about it being the thing for electronics and et cetera is that I don't think that the electron transmission down the DNA circuits, you'd have to put something else in to speed it up, because the mobility of the electron I don't think is very good. So I'm thinking that if they can make graphene 3D, or to have some kind of optical 3D computing system, where the switch times and various other things are faster, that you'd end up with a faster computer. There could be plenty of niche applications for this. You know, the thing is, we're talking about that 3D DNA constructed machine. If you make it huge, it would be massive capability beyond what we have now for anything that we got. But just with, you know, projecting forward 10, 20 years and saying, what else could we do? It might be competing with this thing, and there could be other things that would beat it out. And the other issue would be that you know, Intel has their pathway pushing Moore's Law out to 2029, and it's been a tough competitor and a lot of money behind it. So to switch over to something else, something else can't just beat the current thing by, you know, like 10 times right now. It has to beat the current thing by 10 times, 100 times, and then improve at a rate that's better than the technology that we're developed that we are used to. So it's I think the winner will probably be some kind of 3D optical thing or a mesh together of a hybrid of different things where you have something optimized for different kinds of problems.
Hate to give up on using carbon right away, though, because, I mean, bringing it back around to the environment, this is my favorite form of carbon sequestering. You know, just make intelligence everywhere, you know?
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Plus, we need it. You know, I thought that was the substrate we were all going to be moving to, right? So we can't abandon it altogether.
Right, but
one thing.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was about to shift gears slightly, so go ahead.
Maybe last comment on that, but if you use the DNA with the carbon nanotubes the way IBM is, then you have the fast mobility of carbon of electrons and carbon nanotubes, so you could get the best of both worlds there, which is probably what I've been working on.
Okay. That's what we need, is the best of both worlds. Now, one of the things I read in your notes was this comment: for the energy economy, kilograms are maybe too small a unit. How does that tie into what we're talking about here?
I was actually cutting pasting that from a discussion that I was having in the lifeboat email list with someone else, actually, a Dr. Weber, and he put that that comment out there, the kilograms were too small. I happen to agree with that in order to solve all the any problem, even if we have nanotechnology, if we only have a kilogram of the nanotechnology material, that might not be enough to address the big problem that we have because of the scale of the problems that we have with energy, that it will take a lot, you know, of even, you know, lightweight nanotechnology solar cells to really impact the problem. So if we have,
and that's one of the big challenges with scaling nanosystems anyway, isn't it? When you're dealing with these very tiny quantities, it's hard to scale up to even visible sizes, even appreciable quantities of things, much less to get to kilograms, and then from there to get to maybe, you know, metric tons, which is probably more the amount of the kinds of things that we're talking about that that you would need. But does the fact that, you know, when we talk about something like using DNA, and getting back to my growing it all in vats analogy, you know, mm-hmm. does the fact that you have this kind of potential for exponentially growing, for doubling the amount of material that you're working with, does that help to conquer that problem, do you think?
I think definitely it could. That's, there's work to turn cells into factories. That was, I think, recent work that Ned Seaman was involved in, where his original, I think, making a cross or whatever out of DNA, that they put that the DNA sequence to make that cross into cells that replicate. So they made a trillion copies of his material using cells. So leveraging the cellular machinery to be the production, exponential production factory for what he's doing. But I think in terms of where we're at and getting gauge on that would be we have many companies working to make algae into biofuels, and you can kind of look at, you know, that's easier than what we're talking about, although related, and you can see how, you know, the issues they have scaling that process up. Like if we were to be able to scale up algae into biofuels, then that would be kind of an early indication that we can get the scale also for DNA nanotechnology, because we're managing vats and feedstocks and producing many thousands, millions of tons of algae for making biofuel, then, you know, they could also have some other cells that make DNA material.
Well, it's amazing how these things all kind of interplay with each other, and how progress on one of these pathways speaks to progress on another. Of course, obviously, we've talked quite a bit about biofuels from algae, and it seems that there are some really interesting developments occurring there. And of course, one of the great advantages to producing it that way is just that algae is this, you know, nasty, slimy stuff that reproduces like crazy. I mean, you know, that becomes a big problem in a lot of settings. You know, people who have ponds and or you know, often in fresh water you have this issue with algae forming, and you don't want it there because you want to keep your golf course looking nice, or you want people to be able to swim in your lake, or something like that. So you take that that ability to reproduce, and you turn that into an advantage.
Yeah, it fills quite a lot of our oceans too. So.
Well, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking with futurist Brian Wong about a variety of topics, and I think we're just about ready to shift gears. I haven't gotten the complete high sign yet from Michael Darling, but let me just say that in the background, Brian, as we've been talking, Michael has been putting together one of our two-to-one programs, and this is going to be fun because he's actually going to, I think, Michael, you're there, right?
I'm here.
Okay, you're going to pull it on all three of us at the same time. So Stephen and
that's good. We'll actually get to play along as well this time. That's good.
Yeah, we'll be.
You got to give me one more minute.
Okay.
Oh, one more minute. Okay.
Okay. Well, I have a quick one of the comment in terms of the scale of materials was just carbon nanotubes themselves, which were discovered over a decade ago by Smalley and other people. The factory that produced those currently only produce about 100 or so tons, and there's some work to get some factories by Bayer and some others by 2012 and stuff to get up to 1,000 tons. But the carbon fiber only is produced by about in around the 15,000, 50,000 ton range. So just straight up bulk production of those materials is still, relative to the billion of tons for steel and cement are still far smaller.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously still a lot easier to produce large quantities of things when we're dealing with large quantities to begin with. I mean, it's almost the logic of it is
it's
kind of glaringly obvious, if not a little bit depressing. Yeah.
But you got to start somewhere, and
right.
we're on the chessboard now.
Right.
That's right. And what'll be interesting will be when we reach the point where we're actually able to, Stephen, you talk about the end game, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the visions that that we have for nanotechnology or. For the singularity, but this vision of a world in which you're able to produce material much, much faster using these kinds of technologies than you are the old macro-scale technologies. When that occurs, it would seem to me that we've passed, we've turned a corner.
Right. Well, a lot of these things we've been talking about tonight would lead to something called a nanofactory, where you basically just program in whatever it is you want, be it a laptop or any material good you want, and just assembles it atom by atom, molecule by molecule. And you talk about a powerful technology there.
Well, that's one of our favorite pet technologies to talk about, isn't it? And so let's think about that. If we're say we're 20 to 30 years away from the weather control balloon system, what kind of time frame, Brian, would you put around something like the system Stephen just described?
I think one of the key aspects in terms of putting the time frame on it is that people have to put the money into it and work towards it and fund the right things. Like a lot of these things could happen a lot sooner if I think people like Ralph Merkel and Robert Freitas had gotten a lot more money a lot sooner. I think now they're getting a $3 million project and stuff and with Philip Moriarty and Bill to try and prove some things out. I think if we were to pick the right project and the right people, things could happen a lot sooner. And then if you don't, just like we had, I think, a lot less progress than we could have had if you don't fund the right things. So these things aren't necessarily inevitable, and you can look at the rate of progress and say, okay, we're kind of blindly stumbling our way there, and looks like we'll get there in a certain amount of time. So, if we're still stumbling towards things, then, you know, it looks like we might get there in 30 years, 40 years, you know, 10 years past, whatever, just by accident or just because of a certain amount of overall progress momentum. But I think if we were to target things and really work towards them and have a plan and really try and make it happen sooner, then it could happen a lot faster.
Yeah, so ultimately I think it comes down to putting the resources together. There's a fundraising aspect to it, I suppose, and also a fund apportionment aspect. Having money going into the right research and you know, just actually enabling the right people to do it.
Right.
Yeah. So it's just about as simple and straightforward as that. We just got to figure out a way to raise, I don't know, what do you think, Brian, a billion or so?
Yeah, $2 billion, yep.
Okay, so anyone listening who wants to donate a billion, that would be a big start. Okay, so I think we're ready to try our 2-to-1, and we've had a change of host of our game show this evening. Stephen, I think you've taken over that role, is that right?
It appears that I have, and we keep putting it off for a second, but I'm going to put it off just a second more while I get myself together here. Michael has done the work behind the scenes, and now I'm going to present it.
Well, Michael gets all the credit because this is his idea, actually. We did that last week.
That's right. I mean,
inspiration. We didn't give him credit for it last week, so
we should have.
Michael, well done putting that together. And Stephen, whenever you're ready, we're Brian and I are just, you know, totally psyched because I want to play this game. I want to see if I can.
Okay. Well, Michael, help me out here. You've sent me some stuff here, and
I sent you two pieces. One came with three, and unfortunately, I didn't proof that one carefully enough because you and Phil will know one of those right away because it was on thespeculus.com.
Okay.
And so I sent you a fourth one so that you could substitute for that one.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right. Well, okay. Here's what we're going to do. I'm going to go with a three here, okay? Let's get started, okay? So one.
All right.
Okay. So remind me, Michael. Two of these are true, and one of them is false. And the idea here is that we're going to pick out the one that is false. Is that correct?
Thus, identifying the two that are true.
That's right. Okay. Okay, Brian, are you ready?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great. And how about you, Phil?
I'm totally ready.
Okay, psyched and ready to go. Here we go.
Yes.
Story number one, scientists extract images directly from brain. Researchers from Japan's ATR Computational Neuroscience Laboratories have developed new brain analysis technology that can reconstruct the images inside a person's mind and display them on a computer monitor. It was announced on December the 11th. According to the researchers, further development of the technology may soon make it possible to view other people's dreams while they sleep. True or false? Now, don't answer. We're going to hit the other two before we finish. All right, number two. Scientists have encountered magma in its true natural habitat, deep below ground. Engineers drilling a new well at a geothermal site in Hawaii recently struck liquid gold, a mass of molten rock that is giving geologists an unprecedented peek at how magma cools today and insights into how continents might have formed billions of years ago. This is the first time scientists have encountered magma in its true natural habitat, deep below ground, says co-author Bruce Marsh, a geologist at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. This is like Jurassic Park for magmatic systems, he adds. All right. Okay, that's story number two. True or false? Now, story number three. Photosynthesizing cyborg. Artificial leaf, gold leaf, excuse me, gold leaf doesn't grow on trees, but it can now harvest power from the sun. A team of U.S. chemical engineers has extracted photosynthetic molecules from plants and attached them to thin sheets of gold, creating a photosynthesizing cyborg. In previous work, a protein complex known as PS1, extracted from spinach leaves, remained active while immobilized on a gold surface. Since then, the process for extracting PS1 from plants has been perfected, says Jennings, laying the ground for his group to use those light harvesting proteins to make an artificial leaf. True or false?
Wow. Okay. So we got
Michael. You went out of your way on this, didn't you? I mean, these are awesome.
It's the power of the internet.
Okay, so we got three stories there, Brian. Two true, one false. Do you have a thought initially as to which one is which, or which one is the false one? I'll let you go first.
I think the first two are true, and the third one is false. I've in my extensive scanning of the internet news, I've heard of the first two and heard of the third one.
Okay, well, I know for a fact the first one is true, or at least it's as true as anything that's ever published on the Speculous, because that one was one we did a blog post on. So that one is true. That leaves those other two. And I have to say that the third one sounds completely convincing to me. I don't hear that, and no alarm bells go off. But the magma thing, who would make that up? That's just not interesting enough to make up for it to be false. So therefore, on an interesting level, I'm going to say that the cyborg one must be false. So I'm going to agree with Brian. First two are true, third one is false.
My problem with saying that the third one is false is that on Fast Forward Radio about a month ago, I brought it up. It was a story that, basically a scientist somewhere was saying, we have the leaf. And what he meant by that was that he had, we have now artificially created all the systems necessary to do photosynthesis artificially. And, I suspect that the third one is the false one as well, and I guess that's the one I'm going to go with, even though, it's close enough to the truth that it doesn't ring alarm bells. So, but still, I'm going to go with number three as well. So I guess that's 3-for-3 on saying that number three is the false one. How are we doing, Michael?
I'm holding an envelope in my hand. And here's the deal. A couple of weeks ago, when I proposed to you guys, hey, let's do this new feature, 2-to-1, where we pick three science facts, or perhaps pseudo facts, and we'll do it so that two of them are true and one of them is false. My thinking was that I read these news stories anymore. I can't tell if it's The Onion writing about it and it's ridiculous, or it's two guys in their basement lab and they actually did it. And so the correct answer for tonight's three selections is, in fact, perhaps unfair, because all three are true.
Ah!
I shouldn't have doubted, because I knew that I'd heard this story recently about, we have the leaf.
And so my point would be this, and in the future I will stick to the format and be honest up front that either one is false or two are false or whatever. But my point is this: going into it, I told the three of you, hey, two of these are true and one is false. And the one that was on the Speculous, you, Phil, right away, oh, I saw that one, I know that one's right. Brian, same thing. Well, I've seen these two, and I know that other one, I haven't actually seen it. And here comes Stephen. Wait a minute, I think I did see that, but thinking one of them's false, you go, oh, that can't be true. It is true. All three of them are true. And that's, we're I would say, fairly savvy, both news-informed people and techno-savvy informed on what's likely and what's possible, and here comes somebody saying, hey, there's this thing, and you go, that's crazy, and it's true. Or here's this thing, and you go, that makes perfect sense, and it's ridiculous because it's impossible.
Well, it just goes to show we're living in the future, as Phil has reminded us time and again.
It's a great object lesson for us, Michael, but of course we will never, ever trust you again.
Fair enough.
I feel that's, you know, that's the second lesson I've learned there. But no, but it really is a great point. I mean, the rules of the game insisted that something be false, and we were all too ready to believe that one of them were. And it's really interesting, Stephen, that you knew that one was a little groupthink, I guess, kind of set in there.
Well, yeah, a little bit. But, you know, you remember last week, Phil, when we set up the deal, and you came up with a false one. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
You took a true story and twisted it just a little bit enough to make it false so that,
right.
You know, you could have heard the news story and think, well, that must be true because you had heard the first half of what you said, but you had invented the second half. So I thought, you know, maybe I had not, maybe that news story had been twisted a little bit. So, anyway, that was kind of.
Oh, okay, okay. So yeah. So you were accepting that the game was actually being played as described, as we all were.
Yeah.
And I guess the interesting thing here is when we first said we were going to do this feature. I thought it would be fun. I thought, well, we'll have these really, as we always do, these really smart people on the show. We'll see if we can stump a really smart guy. And Brian, now we have managed to stump you tonight by lying to you. Okay. The beauty of it. I don't think we would have fooled him otherwise. I think we had to go dishonest to make that
happen. Kobayashi Maru. We cheated.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we gave you the no-win scenario. So, well, thanks for playing along, and thanks for being on the program. It's always great having you on, and gosh, we got into some really interesting stuff. We look forward to having you on again sometime soon.
Thanks a lot. It was a lot of fun. I look forward to being on again.
Great, and happy holidays to you, Brian.
You too.
Okay, Stephen, I guess we're running a little late, so you said you had some... something interesting going on with the music tonight. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, we've been doing the week. This program is a weekly show now for over a year. I think that we've had at least 60 shows. I would think by now.
At least, in
the weekly format, I'm kind of proud of this fact. During this time, we've had a different song play us out every single week, and I've made a project of trying to find, you know, good or at least interesting music to finish the show up with, without ever repeating myself. Well,
and we've done this without incurring any wrath of the RIAA or anyone else. I think
that's right. It's all PodSafe stuff. You know, we get out there and we find bands that are asking us, please play my music so people can hear it, and I can get known that way, and so that's what we've been doing, and without fail, we've been able to find interesting good music. I think according to my taste anyway, I just ran out of time this week. I mean, with shopping for the kids and my wife and this and that, and and I just said, well, what can I dust off and play, and give to them again, again? And that's right, I'm re-gifting for the holidays.
And I believe that. Oh, okay, gotcha. That's the song we played around this time last year. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And
this
is the Alice Project singing Regifting for the Holidays. So that's we're playing it again.
Regifting for the Holidays by the Alice Project. All right, great. Good work, Stephen. That's brilliant. Brilliant rationale on your part. Well done. And thanks. It was fun as always. All the best to you and Michael. Enjoy your Christmas, and we'll look forward to being with you all again on the next Fast Forward Radio. Until then, good night.
Out of cash, what to do?